The following is yet another thoughtful sermon request. Dear Richard, recently, due to COVID-19, I attended a beautiful outdoor baptism. The sun was rising over a sparkling sea. There was a chorus of birds singing praises to the beauty of creation. Little children were playing in the sand next to their parents holding their brand new baby. And lastly, the image that will forever be transfixed in my mind. The young godparents holding a large clamshell filled with seawater, the primordial waters from which we all came. And then it happened. The officiant delivered the opening words. Reading the prescribed liturgy, he proceeded to tell the congregation that the act of baptism washes away the little baby's original sin. At which point the parents and the godparents stopped smiling and bowed their heads toward the sand. Now my heart went out to the minister. As soon as those words came out of his mouth, he looked mortified. He too felt the extreme disconnect of the moment. So I thank God for his sweepingly beautiful closing prayer that redeemed every syllable of that puzzling liturgy. He closes with these words. So tell me, Richard, what's your take on the doctrine of original sin? My take is as follows. The legend of Adam and Eve is by far the most misunderstood and misused story in the entire Bible. Most Christians, me included, were taught that the story of Adam and Eve is all about the fall or original sin. The literal belief that 3,000 years ago, two people took a bite out of an apple, and as a result, the entire human race was born sinful. Or as one religious encyclopedia put it, born totally depraved with a heredity stain. I don't buy it. I refuse to believe the little boy that was baptized on the beach that day had a heredity stain. Ask any child psychologist and they will tell you that the quickest way to create a criminal is to tell a child their whole life that they are sinful and shameful, that they have a bad seed. And pretty soon they'll start believing it. And pretty soon they'll go out and prove it to the world. But the opposite is true as well. Tell a child that they are loved, that they are blessed, even when they occasionally make a wrong choice, and they will begin to image that as well. So I much prefer the description of humanity in Psalm 8. What are human beings that you are mindful of them, O God? You have made them a little lower than yourself and crowned them with glory and with honor. Tell that to a child and watch them soar. A few years ago, Walter Brueggemann wrote a landmark commentary on the book of Genesis. Commenting on the Adam and Eve story, he writes, "This text is commonly treated as the account of original sin or the fall. Nothing could be more remote from the narrative itself." Bill Moyers and company concur. He assembled a distinguished panel of people from all walks of life, theologians, both Christian and Jewish, university professors, several writers, clinical psychologists, philosophers, artists, and even a Zen teacher. They sat down together and read the entire book of Genesis, and they talked about it as they read along. And when they came to the story of Adam and Eve, they made the following observation. It is important to note that sin is not mentioned once in the Adam and Eve story. Rather, the word sin is mentioned for the first time when Cain murders Abel. So what's the story of Adam and Eve really about? Why is it included in the Bible anyway? I believe John Steinbeck answered this question beautifully and succinctly. The Adam and Eve story is about living in the real world. It's about you and me living east of Eden. Years before that, Thornton Wilder put it like this, Man is not an end, but a beginning. We are the beginning of the second week of creation. We are children of the eighth day. We are children of the eighth day, living east of Eden. Let's take a closer look. As you may remember, there are two creation accounts in the book of Genesis. In the first one, God created the earth in 6 days, including human beings. Male and female, God, he, she created them in his, her image. And then on the seventh day, God looked at creation, including humans, and said, "This is good. This is really, really good." And then God rested. The second creation story, the story of Adam and Eve, is about what happens next. What happens beginning on the eighth day? From an evolutionary standpoint, it describes the stage where humans, unlike other animals, begin to reason. When instead of acting purely from instinct, they begin to struggle with choosing between right and wrong. So I like to believe that the story originated like this. 3,000 years ago, 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, after a dinner of wild game and homemade wine, a huge extended family is sitting around this campfire. And eventually some of them begin to entertain timeless questions. The same questions that we all ponder today. Why do people make such good and bad choices? Why, unlike the animals, do we have to till our ground for food? Why is there pain at childbirth? And finally, the perennial question, why do people have to die? At which point, a wise grandparent answers by doing what grandparents do best. By telling a story, by saying, "Once upon a time, once upon a time, there were two people named Adam and Eve." It was their way of explaining what it means to be fully and freely human, about the burden and blessing of choice and living with the consequences, about plowing the soil and planting and worrying and praying for rain and cursing when it doesn't come. About the pain and joy of having children, about living in the real world east of Eden, where people love and hate and laugh and cry and dream and die. The authors of Genesis would be shocked to learn that people today actually believe the Adam and Eve story literally. New Testament scholar John Dominic Crossan put it like this: "We tend to believe that ancient people told simple, literal stories that we are now smart enough to recognize as such." Not quite, he says. Actually, those ancient people told smart metaphorical stories that we are sometimes simple enough to take literally. And my favorite from Rabbi Harold Kushner: "I don't take the story of the Garden of Eden as an actual event, i.e. the human race beginning with two full-grown Hebrew-speaking adults and a talking snake. But I do believe the story tells us something profoundly true about the emergence of the human race." And then he writes this: "The Garden of Eden is a tale not of paradise lost, but of paradise outgrown. Not of original sin, but of the birth of consciousness." Now, personally, I believe this beautiful story is a metaphor for God as parent. Stop and think about it. God creates humans. Like every loving parent, he watches their every move. She gives them everything they need, food and drink and shelter. In addition, he makes all the choices for them. They decide nothing. They have no responsibility. And then one day, God gives them the greatest gift of all, the freedom to choose for themselves, the freedom to obey or to disobey. And when his children disobey, they do the same thing our children do, don't they? They blame each other. "But he gave me the cookie, but she gave me the apple." And yet God continues to love them. Even when they choose wrong, God continues to love us as blessed children. Case in point, my favorite verse in this passage, my favorite image. And the Lord God knit together garments of skin for the man and the wife and clothed them and drove them from the garden. I love that. God knits together clothing for them and then drives them out of the garden, both of which are acts of love. There's a number of medieval and Renaissance paintings that show Adam and Eve leaving the garden with tears in their eyes. But I have a feeling there were tears in God's eyes as well when he drove them away. So leaving Eden is a metaphor for growing up, for becoming fully and freely human. And sooner or later, every child has to do it. From the breast to the bottle, from mommy and daddy to the babysitter, to being dropped off for that first day of preschool. I will never forget when I drove my daughter to preschool on her first day, how as I walked away, she looked back over her shoulder and gave me a look as if to say, "How dare you leave me in this God-forsaken place?" Having to leave the comfort and safety of home feels a lot like leaving paradise. And I can tell you firsthand, it doesn't get any better on the first day of college. Years later, I drove my daughter out of Eden to her first day of college. And during our long car ride, I preached a mini sermon about making all the right choices and reaping the consequences of the wrong, to which Sophie smiled and lovingly rolled her eyes. So that's my take. That's what I believe about the story of Adam and Eve. Leaving Eden is a metaphor for living in the real world, with all of its beauty and tragedy, with its free choice, with its major and minor notes. Several years ago, Professor William Meal delivered the Ingersoll Lectures at Yale Divinity School, and his text was our text for today, Adam and Eve. Now, I don't remember his exact words. I listened to it on a cassette tape, which is long ago unraveled. But he closed saying something like this. About a year after they were driven from Eden, Adam and Eve are lying next to each other under a huge canopy of glimmering stars. Suddenly Eve looks over at Adam and says, "You know, Adam, when we lived in Eden, I was never afraid when you didn't come home right away at night. And yet at the same time, my heart never leapt for joy when you returned safely." Adam smiled and said, "You know, Eve, my bones ache. My bones ache from tilling and planting and harvesting. But look over there, Eve, look at our crop. Our fruit is tastier than the fruit in Eden, even the forbidden fruit, because we planted it and we cared for it. And we tilled for it. And we tilled it from the sweat of our brows. And look at our family, Eve, delivered in the throes of pain, to be sure, but conceived in passion and human love. And yes, it's true, living out here, we hunger and we thirst and we sweat and we bleed. And yet there are other times when we are totally fulfilled, when we dance and when we dream." They were both silent for a while. Finally, Adam whispered to Eve, "Don't tell God, Eve. Don't tell God, but I don't feel punished. And I don't feel fallen. And I don't feel sinful. Rather, I feel blessed, truly blessed." And having heard every word, somewhere across all the ravages of time, God smiled.